Welcome to 239 Uncensored. Everything Southwest Florida and beyond with your host, Tim Jarrett. This podcast covers it all. Real talk on issues from real estate to real crime. Join the discussion on hot topics to politics. Don't get left behind. Be in the know about everything Southwest Florida and beyond.
Yeah, 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 239 Uncensored, and welcome to the studio. We got Rich Hampton. Finally, we get you in the studio, Rich. I'm excited. How's that feel? What's it look like?
I'm really looking forward to this. I'm a little nervous because I'm used to just being on my cell phone, and you've got this whole production you've put together here with the studio, but tonight's guest is, I've been looking forward to this all week.
Yeah, this is going to be unbelievable. You guys will love this guy. Bob Stash, Chicago PD, has been involved in everything up there in Chicago. He's actually, you know, known as to be, you know, Chicago's toughest cop. And he's been involved in everything. Bob Stash, way back in 1990, mid-90s, came down to Collier County and did a lot of training with us. We were actually with him one-on-one with our unit. He really brought a lot of that training and a lot of that education to us down here in Collier County. It was fantastic.
Can you imagine being a gang cop in Chicago for three decades? Late 70s, retired not too long ago, 14 gunfights.
14. That's crazy. We're going to go ahead and see if we can get him on the line. Let's reach out to him now. Let's get Bob. You got to stick around for this one.
It's going to be awesome.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Hey, you know, I am honored to have Bob Stash on our 239 Uncensored. Hey, Bob, you know it's uncensored probably just because of you.
The Bob Stash.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to try not to insult anybody, so let's go with it.
All right. Well, hey, so real quick, this whole, you know, Chicago's toughest cop thing, you know, that's a pretty big thing. I mean, we're talking Chicago PD. How many people work at Chicago PD?
Right now, they're probably about 13,600, 13,700, something like that.
Shit. So when you're the toughest cop in Chicago, and I know you're never going to probably admit to that one, but when you're you're the toughest cop in Chicago, I mean, how do you get a reputation like that? I mean, I know you're never going to give us that, but what are some of the things that, you know, you did early on and some of the things you've seen, and what is that like?
Well, first of all, that toughest cop stuff's a bunch of bullshit. There's no such thing as a tough cop. The only tough cops are the ones that have paid the ultimate sacrifice and the ultimate price. And unfortunately, Amen. We've had well over 500 of them since the existence of the Chicago PD. So I really don't like those names or anything like that. But I think what it comes down to is that, you know, we realize in Chicago, and I'm sure most police departments are the same way, about 80% of the police work is really done about by 20% of the guys. And I was always part of that 20%. I worked with extremely aggressive policemen who worked in extremely aggressive units that wanted to do nothing but take bad people off the street and make the street safe. And when that happens, you got to mix it up sometimes, you know, and whether it's with fists or nightsticks or firearms, you got to do it. And I think that's what eventually happened. And like I say, that there's a lot of other guys out there, a hell of a lot tougher than me and a hell of a lot better than I could ever hope to be.
Hey, Bob. So what year did you start with? I know you started with an agency before Chicago PD, but what year did you start in law enforcement?
1977.
Wow. And you were with Chicago PD in what, 79?
I went to Chicago in 81.
81. Can you walk us through kind of how the start of your career went and how you, because between the TAC units and patrol and homicide detective, I mean, we'd be here all day talking about the positions you held, but can you highlight some of those for us?
Yeah, well, mostly the tactical units. So tactical units in the city, for those people who might be listening and aren't aware of them, are plainclothes units that work within the districts. Now, when I came on the job, there were 25 districts. They've reduced it down to 22 districts now to consolidate and save some administrative money. But each district had a TAC team, and the TAC team was anywhere between 30 and 50 guys. They worked in plain clothes, and their primary responsibility was narcotics and gangs, and that's all you did. You went out there and handled the gang violence, and you handled the narcotics situation. So when I got into patrol, again, coming from a suburban police department. I'd had some experience on the street. I had already 18 months undercover work in a county MEG unit, which is Metropolitan Enforcement Group, like a countywide narcotics team. So I had a little bit more experience than the average guy coming on the street. And by the time I got off of probation, a district commander had come to me and said, hey, listen, on such and such day, you're going to start on the TAC team. I said, boss, I only got about 14 months on the job. You know, I really don't think I should be on a TAC team yet. I'd like to get to know this job a little better. He said, no, dude, you're making a lot of arrests. You're embarrassing the rest of the guys. You're going on the TAC team. That's all there is to it. And that was it. I went from district to district on TAC teams. I worked narcotics teams several times in several districts. Made sergeant. Went to a district as a patrol sergeant. And within about 2 months of that, I got a TAC team, actually a gang mission team. So it was part of the TAC unit, but my guys handled nothing but gangs. And I did that for years. And then I went to the detective division and worked homicide for about 6 years as a supervisor, a homicide sergeant on the west side, the most gang-infested area of the city. And then after that, I got promoted to lieutenant, went back into patrol, was a patrol lieutenant and a field lieutenant and what they call a watch commander for, again, a short period of time from like August to December. And then they gave me a TAC team, and I did a TAC team for 15 years. And then after that, I went to Special Functions, which is a citywide unit, and was placed in charge of a brand new unit called the Homeland Security Detail Section. And we handled all the stadiums, ballparks, convention center, Navy Pier, and we did Homeland Security and counterterrorism for the last 6 years until I turned 63 and they mandatorily said time to retire. Here I sit talking to you guys now.
Yeah, big deal, right? Big deal. No, yeah. So take us back a little bit. Chicago, you know, we all know Chicago, gangland, right? That's where it all, yeah, where it all derived from. So can you take us back a little bit, in the, you know, in the 80s, 90s, some of the just, I mean, unbelievable thing, gangster disciple days. You know, walk us through that.
Well, you know, back in the day, so the big gangs, the major gangs that are now known nationwide, other than the Bloods and Crips, of course, all started in Chicago. And back in the 80s and that, they were actual gang nations. And what I mean by that is there was a CEO at the top, and that guy was in charge. You know, the infamous name, Larry Hoover. You know, you can't talk enough about this guy. I mean, matter of fact, they're actually looking at possibly paroling this guy and booting him out of the state system and not putting him in state prison anymore. We don't have to worry about that because he's serving life in Supermax anyway. But, I mean, it's amazing that this guy, this one guy, even from the prison system from the late 80s, actually ran a criminal enterprise that was making somewhere in the neighborhood of about $600 million a year in narcotics nationwide. There was a time where virtually gang factions in Florida, in Tennessee, in Texas, in Colorado, Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, all paid homage to this guy. And almost like a corporate tax paid his big gang money, and all the decisions were being made by this guy from a 5x7 square foot cell in Stateville Penitentiary here in Illinois. And those gangs were huge like that. You had the Black Peastones, the Gangster Disciples, the Black Disciples, the Vice Lords, and then sometimes a little bit slightly smaller factions within those Vice Lords. They had larger groups that had independent leaders in that. Those gangs were gigantic. Nothing was done. It was almost like the mafia. Nothing was done without the big muckety mucks making their decisions and granting approval on it. In the meantime, gangs out west were like little sects and groups and, you know, neighborhood cliques and shit like that. And then all of a sudden what happened was we put away all the big gang leaders. We locked them up in conjunction with the feds and that. We broke up these gangs, the Latin Kings, the Spanish Cobras, the GDs, the BDs, the Vice Lords, the TVLs, everybody else. And then what happened? Well, now you're back to the cliques. Now we're down the neighborhoods. We're the average size gang in Chicago. We've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 55,000 gangs now, all basically cliques. You know, there might be 1,000 of them claiming GEDs, but now when you claim GEDs, it's what neighborhood you're from. And that right. neighborhood clique may legitimately be a block long and may have, 15 guys on it. Well, back in the 90s, when the violence rate was real high, it was because of these bigger gangs fighting for control of parts of the city. They don't fight like that anymore. Now they may just be fighting for a corner tip, and that's about it. But what's worse now is they're fighting over social media. You know, now all the violence, especially what's going on now, a lot of it is based on social media. It's these up-and-coming rap artists in this from one gang faction dissing another guy on Messenger or on Facebook or on Twitter or Instagram or WhatsApp or whatever it happens to be, and somebody's pissed off about it. That's why you don't see graffiti anymore. The new graffiti of the world now is social media for the gangs. And by doing all this dissing, we've got a lot of people killed. We just had a guy killed the other day, a high-ranking gang member from the Jaro City GDs, gunned down in the Gold Coast on a street, Oak Street, 56 East Oak, which is Oak and State in the heart of the Magnificent Mile. He's killed. His buddy's wounded up and his girlfriend shot, jumped on by four guys who pulled up in two different cars and organized it on a street that's loaded with the Bentley dealership, Dolce & Gabbana, Rolex and everything else. I mean, you can't walk into one of these stores without at least 15 grand in your pockets to buy something.
Yeah, and it's pushing
down in an area that would have never happened. Why? Because he posted a YouTube video and he dissed some gang members from old black BDs, and lo and behold, he's dead now.
Yeah, so a lot of the listeners, Bobbert, and I know I was in a training room back in the late 90s where Letcon, never forget that training company, your company, came in and was an advisor to us, and you started giving us the gang Bibles and talking about the 21-man yep. commission and all of these Larry Hoovers and Jeff Forts and Willie Lloyds. And a lot of the local folks in Florida were looking at you like, what the hell is this guy talking about? That's Chicago. Now, you were using the yeah. – I don't want to date this, but we were using the overhead transparencies. If you remember
yes,
that.
Sir.
And the VHS tapes.
A couple VHS tapes.
VHS tapes over at Transparencies and 35-millimeter carousels.
And there's a couple young guys like me that are eating it up, right? And everybody's like, gang, yeah. schmangs, this is Florida. What the crap is this? Literally less than a month later, we pull a gangster disciple Bible out of a local high school from a kid whose mom moved here from Chicago, and he had, yeah. within a matter of a week, begun his recruiting process. So we're looking it's not a conspiracy theory. This has proliferated all over the country, and it's interesting that you bring up the social media because that is absolutely going to drive a lot of that violence.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, first of all, in the old days, you know, it used to be like in Chicago, and you saw it a little bit, you know, it was all colors. Remember the Bloods and the Crips?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Bloods wore red, the Crips wore the blue, and the same thing. We looked at the colors for the different gangs. All the Latin Kings are black and gold, and the Spanish Cobras were red and green, and all this other bullshit. That's all gone. Nobody paints any shit on a wall anymore. You know, you're hard-pressed to find a guy with a spray can putting shit on a wall of his crown or his pitchfork
right.
or any
six-point star.
He doesn't
right.
have to. He's right. doing it all now from his cell phone.
Right.
And he's posting it on Facebook, and he's posting it on YouTube, and he's posting it on Twitter and everything else, and that's how they're communicating. I mean, my guy, I don't know about you guys down there, but up here, I don't know how much you see the news up here, but Jesus, these guys up here are instant messaging and live streaming their drive-bys. That's how we're arresting half of these guys.
Yeah,
they're actually live streaming a gunning a guy down.
Man,
and then
amazing.
They don't think they're ever going to get caught. What do you mean? I didn't think that was going to be there. You
brazen,
know?
Brazen. Hey, so
yeah.
a large part of our audience are law enforcement officers here locally and, mm-hmm. and elsewhere. I don't know if you really want to get into it, but it was something that I got a lot out of as a young cop, I'm talking to you. And I know you've had your share of, and I'm just going to throw it out there, I know you've had your share of gunfights.
Yes,
I think you're up in the area of 14 gunfights in your career. Is that correct?
That's the number.
So here's a question for you. You know, a lot of these cops have never been in a gunfight. Now, we've unfortunately had the unfortunate experience of being shot at, which changes things. But actually getting into an exchange on a gunfight 14 times. And I've read and listened and personally talked to you about that very first gunfight. Can we dive into that a little bit? Because it's going to help our audience.
Jesus yeah. Christ. Hold it. Wait. Just one thing to know here. Don't piss Bob off on this one.
14. 14. But the first gunfight, I'd love to just, can we chew on that, Bob?
Well, the first one in Chicago was, again, it was a local gangbanger. He was selling drugs by a park. My partner and I saw him selling dope. We parked the car a couple blocks away and came out on foot, approached him. All of a sudden, he wasn't there anymore, and we had no idea where he was. And we saw him step out of the vestibule of an apartment building. It was one of the larger apartment buildings, like 40 units, so it had this big, like, almost a U-shaped entryway. Not real deep, but, you know, it was a little bit set back. And he had been back there. That's why we didn't see him. We saw him walk up to the street, make another sale, and then he walked into the lobby of this building. And he was gone again for about 5 minutes. And my partner says, I don't know where the hell he's going and what he's doing. So I'm going to go up there and take a look. You stay over here, and I'm going to see if I can figure out where he's at. We wanted to try to grab him in the act of actually selling to somebody. My partner walked into the lobby of the building, and lo and behold, the guy was just standing in the lobby. I don't know if he was standing outside for whatever reason, count his money, his dope, or whatever. My partner grabbed him, said, come on with me, step outside. I had the radio. My partner steps out from the vestibule of the building into that outside U-shaped area and says, you know, get up against the wall. And the guy says, fuck that, I'll kill you. And he pulls out a butcher knife out of his pants and starts to come at my partner, who just lights him up. Pulls his pistol out. He had a .45 long Colt. He put 6 rounds into this guy at about 4 feet. And the guy said, now I'm going to cut your head off. My partner changes hands, pulls out his 5-shot .38. This guy's bent over. He's trying to climb up on the wall, and he fires down, and he puts 2 into the guy's upper chest and 3 more into his back. Is able to get out into the grassy area. I heard the shots. I call for help. I run up with my gun drawn, and I see my partner desperately trying to reload his pistol. Back then, we all carried revolvers. He's trying to reload his revolver, and this guy's just coming at him with the knife. He's got about a 6.5 or 7-inch bladed knife, and he's yelling, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. My partner's yelling, shoot him, man, I can't load my gun fast enough. Shoot him, shoot him. So I lit him up. I had a .44, and I put 4 rounds into him, and the last round finally dropped him to the ground, and I hit him every time. We hit him with every round we fired. The last one blew his kneecap off and dropped him to the ground. He fought the ambulance crew, he fought the responding cars, and he lived for 10 days after that, and he had virtually no drugs, no nothing in his system, a little bit of marijuana. His blood alcohol content was like 0.09, and that. He was a Cuban Merolito, and he was one of the baddest guys I'd ever come up against.
He wanted to live, I think, Bob.
Yeah, you know, all Will this stuff live. About, you know, cops love to talk about their equipment and guns and their bullets and all this stuff, and they think that that's what's going to save you. You know, oh, you should have hit him center mass. You should have. We hit this guy center mass. I mean, if you would have seen the autopsy report from this guy, we blew almost everything out of his body, and he still lived because that boy did not want to die. And I say as an aside a lot of times, I handled a shooting on the west side when I was a homicide sergeant, and it was a Black Soul gang member that was 31 years old. He took 11 hits from an AK-47.
Holy smokes.
11 hits, including one to the head. Man. That boy's still alive today.
Christ, I get a paper cut, and I'm freaking done.
Yeah. Same with me. Yeah, same with the rest of us. Yeah, you know, we're done. Get shot in the leg, and they end up dying. Yeah. This guy, you know, it's the mindset. They don't want to go. But, you know, from that point on, I mean, he eventually did die of all the gunshot wounds because, I mean, he virtually didn't have an organ left in his body. And, you know, from that point on, I looked at my partner and I said, you know, something ain't right here, dude. You know, you've got a .45 long Colt. I've got a .44 special. And we hit this guy center mass, like, including the 38s, like maybe 9 or 10 times, and I don't understand why this shit didn't work. And we ended up actually, in all honesty, talking to a medical examiner one day, and the medical examiner said, listen, You want to kill a human being, there's only one way to do it. You have to take out his brainstem, which means it had to be a headshot. So from that point on, we started practicing and training to do nothing but shoot for the head, that if we ever got in that situation again, we'd go for headshots, because I didn't plan on dying on this job. I want to be old, fat, and retired like I am now.
Love it.
That's
love
awesome.
It.
That's awesome. Bob, you know, you had 14 officer-involved shootings or gunfights. Back then, back in the day, I guess, you know how things have changed. Were they nearly as scrutinized as they are today? I mean, I'm sure they were good shoots, without a doubt, knowing what you're involved in. But were they nearly as scrutinized?
I would have to say, you know, I'm going to say yes. I mean, most people are going to tell you probably not, that it's a little bit more now. But I think yes. I think the difference is that now it's a little bit more drawn out. You know, it's almost like the, let's put it this way. Here's what has changed, what I think, over the last 25 or 30 years. The facts of the case don't change. And that's what makes what the intent is. Nowadays, they scrutinize everything so that, you know, they'll come out and say, yeah, the shooting was good, but the, you know, but the copper didn't have his hat on properly.
Right.
And, you know, we can get him for that rule violation and that. Back then, that's not what they looked at. Back then, we used to have a thing called a round table. And the round table had a shooting team that usually had a homicide lieutenant in charge of it with a couple of top detectives that handled practically nothing but police-related shootings. And then they were backed up by a huge team of detectives that would go out looking for, you know, video, and they would look for witnesses and canvas and all of that. And then they'd bring all those people into the station, and part of that shooting team was the state's attorney's office. And the state's attorney would interview everybody right then and there.
Right.
Including the Office of Professional Standards. And, you know, they are now the new COPA, the Civilian Review Board. They would interview everybody. And, you know, you'd draw the thing up on the board, and everybody would tell everything. And you'd sometimes be there, like, you know, God forbid, if you were involved in a shooting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that round table would probably go till maybe 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock the next morning.
Wow.
12, and then at the hours. End of that, they would have a preliminary judgment where they would say whether or not, you know, this looks like a good shooting or a bad shooting. Now, it would continue to be investigated, of course, but they would make that preliminary judgment then. Now it seems like the scenes freeze. We hold it. Everybody goes on a 30-day hiatus. You know, the cop gets administrative duty for the 30 days. The state's attorney doesn't even look at the case for 15 or 20 days until the department puts together some type of an investigation. And then they make their decision. So I think the decisions were the same, but they were done a lot more on site, on scene,
right,
in the old days than they are now. You know what I'm saying? It seems like there's a little bit more Monday morning quarterbacking today than there was back then.
It was
just the reality of the facts and the evidence.
And I think you'll agree that you're seeing a lot of people that are putting their two cents in that have no business doing it. Mayors,
oh,
you know, Atlanta, you know, that whole crazy nonsense down there, and people just pumping things up. It's crazy.
I think the biggest detriment that we have going for us right now, and I mean going for us, I'm referring to law enforcement in general, is the fact that everything that a law enforcement officer does, regardless of what state department he comes from, is the fact that everything is politicized. You're either on the left or you're on the right or whatever, and everybody knows better than everybody. I've said this a million times. I don't understand this concept. So if you're a doctor, and you're accused of doing something wrong, and you go in front of a medical board and that, who reviews your actions? Other doctors, right?
Right.
Okay, so if you're a lawyer and you're accused of not handling a case and you go in front of professional registration, who comprises professional registration? Lawyers, right?
Yeah.
Why is it that policemen are never judged by other policemen? They're judged by civilians who have no knowledge, no training of the law, no knowledge of police work, and have never walked up a project building through a piss-covered hallway with me, but they're going to determine that what I did was right or wrong. That's why I'm adamantly against civilian review boards. A review board should be comprised of professional law enforcement officers. Hey. But they'll say right away, well, the copper will, you know, he's always going to back the copper. No, he's not. If we see something wrong, I could recognize good from bad.
And we got
I know the difference between right and wrong. I enforced that difference for 42 fucking years. I know what the hell I'm doing.
And you got to admit, Bob, the people that hate bad cops are good cops. There is nobody that hates a bad cop worse than a good cop.
No truer statement has ever been said than what you just said. That is the absolute truth.
So in line,
and the only reason that, you know, they say about this thin blue line and all that, there's only one reason for a thin blue line. It's because we don't want to throw a fellow cop into cannon fodder. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So in other words, if a cop does something wrong, that average citizen that would do the same thing might be charged with a bullshit misdemeanor. That cop's going to get the book thrown at him, and it's going to be a major felony. Why should he be treated any differently than somebody else? You know, like I said, that's the problem with these civilians getting involved in this law enforcement in such a way. You know, nobody tells a garbage man how to pick up garbage. Nobody tells a plumber how to clean a pipe. Nobody tells an electrician how to put in a circuit board. But every asshole with an opinion wants to tell a policeman how to do law enforcement. And we're the only profession like that when you really think about it.
So in line with that, and I'm going to take you down a different path real quick. I know as a rookie,
sure.
One of the things you told me that still, I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday. You said, if you're going to be a gang cop, Rich, you got to understand a couple things. You got to understand that you're dealing with the worst of the worst, but it can't make you part of that worst. You've got to keep a positive attitude, and you got to learn how to communicate with these people, and you got to be able to get in there and try to do what you can to help these people. And I'm thinking, here's this badass cop from Chicago, 14 shootings later, and he's telling me I got to try to help gangbangers. What would you tell a rookie today that's getting into the climate that we're getting into, that's wanting to go to the police academy, wanting to serve his community? What would you tell that? What would you tell that kid?
Well, the first thing that I would tell him is that here's where we make the biggest mistake. Again, I mentioned this before when I talked about cops and gadgets and gizmos. Cops love gadgets and gizmos, you know. You take a look at a policeman's belt today. I don't know how you guys can even walk
around.
It's
a freaking bat belt. You give them Velcro and anything black, they're going to stick it on their belt, right? The bat belt?
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, the average cop right now is going around. He's carrying a gun. He's carrying ammo. He's carrying radio. He's carrying a body camera. He's got a collapsible baton. He's got pepper spray. He's got a taser. He's got a little pouch with his gloves in it. He's got his tourniquet. He's got a medical kit. He's got this. He's got everything. He, like you say, he's like Batman. Training him to use is the most powerful weapon in that body, and that's his brain. The most powerful weapon is the brain, and the most powerful way to implement that brain is to speak. And the problem with most law enforcement, and I go for this because I believe in this community policing aspect, you want to learn what's going on in your community. You want to deal with gangbangers or narcotics violators or citizens that are going to back you up. You need to get out and talk to people. Nobody wants to talk to anybody. And we in law enforcement have done that by giving us cell phones and MDT computers in the cars and everything else, because a copper basically gets in his car, rolls his windows up, turns his air conditioning on, and doesn't deal with anybody unless he gets a 911 call.
Yeah.
That's not the way I did policing.
Yeah, it's
my partner and I park a car. We'd park the car in the street and get out, and we'd walk the neighborhood. Sometimes we'd sit on a porch. I can't tell you how many times as a copper sitting on a porch, we'd sit there watching what's going on in the neighborhood, and the door opens, and we turn around. Some guy says, "What you doing on my porch? You guys don't live here." "Oh, sorry, sir. You know, we're the police. We just, stay here. You guys want some lemonade or something? I appreciate the fact you're watching what's going on." Does anybody do that? No. I remember taking bags of sliders. I'd go to White Castle and get one of them 30 cartons of sliders and shit like that. I'd stop at the basketball court and take them out to the kids playing basketball and all that shit.
That's good stuff.
I've been out here for a while. You look like you were hungry. And I'd start talking to those guys.
Yeah.
I had some of the baddest gangbangers. I had a badass gangbanger one day. I'll never forget this. He had a warrant out for him, and they wanted to arrest him. A couple of my guys stopped him, and one of them called for help. He says, "Hey, this guy's getting belligerent. He's getting aggressive. Give me another car over here." So we showed up, and, man, this guy was ready to fight the whole world. I got out of the car, and he sees me, and he says, "Stasher, what's going on?" I said, dude, what are you doing? He says, well, these guys, you know, he's manhandling me and all that shit. I said, well, dude, you know, you got a warrant for battery on your girlfriend. He says, ah, it's bullshit. I said, dude, I know it's bullshit, but you got to go. He goes, well, I ain't going with these motherfuckers because I don't like them. But I'll tell you what, I'll go with you. I said, all right, get in the car, let's go. So I threw him in the back seat of the car and took him to jail. And it was no problem.
But that,
why? Because he knew me.
That takes That takes a lot of buildup, Bob. I mean, that just doesn't happen overnight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but you know what? You got 30 freaking years on the job, for God's sake. Get out of the car.
I agree.
Put your phone down. I mean, I can't stand it. Every time I drive past a police car in this day and age, I see some copper holding up his cell phone. He's either FaceTiming with his old lady or he's, you know, searching the web to buy new fishing lures or something. Put that shit away, man. Eight or 10 or 12 hours a day, get out there and do police work. If you don't want to do police work, find another honorable job and get the hell off the job. That's why we got problems in the street today.
No question.
Cops ain't really doing their jobs.
Hey,
now, today, I tell you right now, in the atmosphere that's going on, the first thing I'd say to these coppers is, I'd be careful. You know what? I would now sit back like a fireman and do only the 911 calls.
Exactly.
But that doesn't preclude you from being able to go places and talk to people.
Right. Develop those relationships.
Yeah. Especially. Yeah. They didn't enter as, you know, we're always, let's combat gangs. That's the most ludicrous, stupid thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Let's combat the gang. Everybody in that gang entered that gang as an individual. Why are we going over at the entity? What you got to do is pluck out one individual at a time. One individual at a time. You turn that individual. If a gang's got 10 members and you convince 6 of them that gang life is no good anymore, and they get on and they get an education and they get a job and they start doing something, the other 4 shitheads are by themselves. Now they got to recruit, and then you got to make it harder for them to recruit. And then before you know it, you know, you can't have a gang if you don't have any members. So you've got to go after these people as individuals.
Pick them off.
I don't give a shit if it's a murderer down to a guy pissing on the street corner.
But, Bob,
you got to talk to as an individual.
Bob, you got to admit, Chicago is a great place. It's a great place to visit, great place to be from. But there is some crazy shit that goes on in Chicago. Timmy, do you remember?
Oh, God, yeah.
Do you remember we're up there teaching a gang class in East Chicago, just outside of Gary, Indiana?
Yeah, Maryville, yeah. Indiana.
Maryville.
We call Stash and we say, hey, we're down teaching the feds an advanced gang class. Let's call Stash up and let's go get some dinner. You said, okay. So we go up to the South District. You were a watch commander at the time down in the, I think it's District 1, Robert Icky Project area, Bob.
Yep.
And, so we go into your shift briefing. You're throwing keys to a kid to drive a tow truck as part of his shift. I'm like, you drive a tow truck? Holy shit. How many cops, how many agencies have tow trucks on shift? That was the first thing that kind of blew me away. We go have dinner. I didn't realize, you know, Stash is that old salt. He's that old watch commander that's going to let, you know, he does the Hill Street Blues type briefing, gives everybody their assignments. We go out and roll around. Later that night, he gets a call. They have a scooter by. I can't make this shit up. A gangbanger used one of those scooters like you'd buy your kids at Christmas. You know what I'm talking about, Tim?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And he goes by the Robert Icky Projects and shoots it up. Shoots up the damn projects. And Stash treats it just like another call. He's like, yeah, we got to drive by. And
let's roll over
let's
there.
Let's roll over there and see what we got. Meanwhile.
Well, the difference.
Go ahead.
You know, the crime is basically the same everywhere, but here it's the volume. You know, Chicago is a compacted city. You know, everybody talks about New York. New York's a vertical city. You know, it's straight up. And L.A. is a lateral city. It's real wide. Chicago is that combination of the two. You know, we're a pretty good-sized city, but we're compacted. But we got a lot of shitheads here. I mean, you know, this is the birthplace of the Midwest. You got half-sophisticated people and half-Western hillbillies here. You got a little bit of everything. And these kids out there, you know, they'll do anything. It's just the volume of what we have is so astronomical.
Bob.
You know, why don't you think about it?
Yeah. Fill us in a little bit. I mean, what the fudge? What the hell? What the heck is going on? I'm seeing, you know, 60, 70 shootings on any given weekend.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on?
We're going back to the way it was in the 90s. And what it is it's a result of the Ferguson effect that started with Ferguson. The coppers out here don't want to become the next YouTube video because they're persecuting and prosecuting policemen left and right. So cops are now becoming like firemen. They sit in the car and they wait for the 911 call. They handle it and then they wait for the next 911 call. there's no more aggressive policing out there. You know, that's a big problem. And then I got to tell you what happened to our department, and I'll say it now as a retired guy. I could really say it, and I love it. The problem is we brought all these carpetbaggers in here, the run this department. You know, we from Weiss to McCarthy to Brown to all these outsiders, including the guy that we had temporarily from Los Angeles running the show for a short period of time. I mean, it'd be like me coming down by you guys and without having any idea of what Collier County is like, running for sheriff. And then I become sheriff, and I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know your bad sections of town. I don't know your good sections of town. I don't know who your strong administrative commanders are. I don't know who your poor administrative commanders are. I don't even know the neighborhoods. I don't even know where to go to get a good steak. You know what I'm saying? And yet these assholes now are in charge of a department of 13,600 men trying to police a city of 2.8 million with a crime rate that makes New York and L.A. combined look like an amateur show. And then we got a guy now from Dallas who comes in here, and he ain't here like a month. We've got 112 homicides, and he's here like a month, and this is like in March. And he says, yeah, I don't think we're going to have more than 300 homicides. We're 455 already. Are you kidding
already?
Me?
It's August.
We're 455, and it's half a year. We'll probably top 800 this year.
Jesus.
Without even trying. And it's supposed to be a hot and shitty weekend. You know, I mean, these poor coppers got to work this every single day.
So
every day.
The one thing I can tell you, and you're more than welcome, because you know we always have a home for you down here. We have had great success with our leadership to hold the line. And I will tell you that our administration and our cops, and this isn't just bullshit, this is real. And I think you saw it when you were down here in the 90s as one of our advisors. We're holding the line, and we're fighting crime, and we're not going to let a lot of those distractions, at least our sheriff's not, that much I can promise you, and our colonel, they make it clear every night we're going out there, and we're not going to just sit back like firefighters and let people dictate how we spend our day. We're going to find those predators, we're going to find those criminals, and we're going to take them to jail. That's what we're going to do. And because of that, our crime is held.
And I respect guys like that. The guy that I respect the most right now leading the big city police department is Chief Craig from Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit, yeah.
Chief Craig's one of the baddest bosses I've ever seen, man. He stands up there and says, listen, I'm going to support my people. We're going to fight crime. I don't want anybody to be victimized in the city of Detroit. And if these people are pushing us and coming after us and rioting and this, he says, I told my guys, we are not retreating. We are not backing up. Man, that's a patent and a grant and everybody, all these major generals wrapped into one. I'd love to hear something
hell
like
yeah.
That. These riots here in Chicago that stem from all of this crap that happened up in Minneapolis. And we've got 500 coppers standing on the street near the Trump Tower because they're trying to burn it down. And they're being pelted with rocks and bottles and bricks. And the moron mayor that we got and a superintendent, this Brown, says, don't put on any riot gear yet because it looks too aggressive.
You go stand out there.
We got like 20 coppers in the hospital with broken bones and split open heads hit with bricks because they couldn't put their helmets on. It took the guy nearly a month before he authorized them to wear riot gear during the riots. I'm glad to be retired because I could not do policing under these conditions. And that's why a lot of the upper echelon of my department, my old department in Chicago, is retiring, because a lot of them, like me, are looking down and looking at the light at the end of the tunnel. And instead of it being a bright future for the city, it's starting to look dark and bleak because, again, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, guys, the biggest problem in law enforcement in this day and age is that it's been politicized. And the minute you politicize law enforcement, you've got a nationwide problem.
But, Bob, didn't you see this a little bit? I mean, you started in the late 70s, right? And the political climate was similar. I mean, I'm not saying it's the same thing, but you saw this between the political climate then, the crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s. Oh. You know, you've seen law enforcement and the evolution come left and right. Do you think we're going to swing back to the direction post 9/11 where people actually admired what law enforcement does?
I believe we will, because I believe that law enforcement is, in fact, cyclical. You know, just like you said, you know, we have the good times and the bad times, the good times and the bad times. And we keep going back and forth like that, you know. And we don't seem to understand it because, you know, law enforcement – the way we do things changes because we rely, again, and I can't stress this enough, guys, we get to a point, especially now, we rely on technology. You know, from the 70s, look at the technology we had in law enforcement compared to what we have now. And the more that you rely on the technology, again, the more you take away from the policeman as a human being, you know, using his brain and his mouth and his ability to socialize and talk. We'll come back because eventually what's going to happen is, like happened before, is people will get fed up and they'll start saying, hey, look, I ain't taking this anymore.
Right.
You know, or right. Somebody prominent's going to get hurt or killed. And then you'll see a dramatic change. Somebody will take the gloves off and they'll tell New York, start acting like the police again. And they'll do the same thing with L.A. and the same thing. You know, you guys are familiar with Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right?
Oh, that's, yeah.
Not too far.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Milwaukee's a big town, man. Milwaukee's like 680,000 people. They got a pretty good sized police department. They had a really aggressive chief. So he pissed off people because he was an aggressive chief. Guess what they did the other day? The police commission demoted him.
Yeah.
Look it up on in the internet.
Yeah,
they demoted him.
Yeah.
They demoted him down the rank and put a new guy in there because he wasn't towing the political line. So things will change, but it's going to have to come from the people. People are going to have to say, look, I don't want to be a victim. I don't want to be afraid to let my child play in my front yard. And like in Chicago, I don't want to be terrified to send my 10-year-old to a basketball, like this kid that was shot and killed in the Cabrini area.
Yeah, it's crazy.
About a week ago. I mean, 9-year-old tragic. Kid, all he was doing was playing basketball with friends. He was on the basketball court in the park.
Just tragic.
And he got hit by stray bullets. You know, yeah. And he's dead. We've had 39 children under the age of 15 shot in this city already. It's 11 of them killed.
How does that not enrage?
And go on the internet. The numbers are there.
Yeah.
It's terrifying when you think about it. Things have to turn around, but it can't turn around until the good people of society, the working people that are there, the people living in the neighborhoods, do the old Howard Beale from the movie Network, throw the window open and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
That's what it's going to have to
and
take.
Tell the police to be the police. Bad guys need to go to jail. They need to be out on high bonds. They need to be incarcerated sometimes like Larry Hoover for the rest of his fucking life because he's a murdering individual. And if you let him out, he's going to kill more people. I'm going to tell you something. Of all the things I've ever done in law enforcement, and you guys talk about this toughest cop bullshit and these gunfights and that. The only thing I say about that, and I say this to every police officer who's ever had to do that in his life, I can guarantee you one thing. I can never count how many lives I may have saved by doing what I did.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Amen on that one.
Because you don't know. I mean, how many gangbangers do you know, or how many people out there do you know that got 4, 5, 6 bodies behind their names, and they're still walking the streets, and they're not in prison?
Yeah, and so, Bob, yeah, that brings me to the next thing, and Bob, we talked about it right at the very beginning. I don't think you really can comprehend how much your education and efforts and what you gave us early on have really formed and stuck in Collier County. I mean, basically, we started a gang unit. I was lucky enough to be the first sergeant ever in that gang unit. We got the tremendous support from Sheriff Hunter at the time, if you remember him, and then currently Sheriff Ramboss.
Well.
Yeah, Sheriff Ramboss.
Like that guy a lot.
They stick with us. I mean, they stick with us through thick and thin, and they've never backed down on the gangs. I mean, it was easy at one time to, reduce your gang unit and put them over in another unit and do all the different things.
Absolutely.
They've stuck with it. The intel has worked. We were able to get rid of a lot of these gangs way back when, and it's stuck today. We're seeing a lot of the, the neighborhood things that you have talked about, a lot of the social media fighting going on. But as far as the culture and sticking and being able to survive in Collier County, that for the most part has been gone because of what we learned early on from you and in your training and what you taught us back then.
Absolutely. I want to add, Bob, hold on. You're not getting off that easy because I do want to add something. So he's got his Facebook account, which I was glad to see. We connected with Bob on his Facebook account. And I sent you a note the other day, and I really, truly meant every word of that. You were instrumental in my development as a gang cop, which actually set the tone for my career. And I can tell you that your legacy, not just in Chicago, whether it was with when we were with the Florida Gang Investigators Association, thousands of Florida cops, right? Then the National Gang Investigators Association. Then we get on the phone today and I find out you're doing, I'm doing some side work for counterterrorism. What are you not doing? What have you not done in your career, Bob? It's amazing to me. And I can't thank you enough for the stage you set for us, bud.
Well, listen, I can't thank you guys enough because, first of all, no society, city, county, or state would ever be safe if it wasn't for people like you. The boots on the ground, the policeman that goes out there, wants to open his mind, wants to learn, has dedicated to his job, dedicated to his community, dedicated to his profession, and goes out there and gives 110% all the time. Man, the reason that people are safe in the world is not because of me, but people like you. You guys that are working guys that are out there. Never, ever underestimate your ability as an individual. And, man, I'm going to tell you, guys did a great job down there, and I'm proud of you guys. I'm proud of the way that you guys turned out and the accomplishments that you made because that's what we all strive for. You know, and it's nice to know that. Why? Because I know I can come to Collier County anytime I want, and it's going to be a safe county.
Absolutely.
I don't have to worry about looking at my six all the time and be worried about being victimized by any kind of a crime or that, or if I decide someday to move down that way or whatever, I don't have to worry about moving in a gang neighborhood because the sheriff's department, the city's down there, they got their hand on the pulse of the shit that's going on, and they're trying to make it safe for everybody else, and that's all we can hope for. All we can hope for. You guys have accomplished that goal. You should pat yourselves on the back. I'd do it right now, but we're on the phone.
We're going to do it again. Hey, Bob, I'd like to thank you for the call, man. And I really want you on often. So fun to listen to you. I can listen to you for hours. It just goes on and on. But I really appreciate everything you've done for us and what you're doing for law enforcement. You're continuing to do it. And just being able to, you know, be you, that's important. So thanks for the call. And, you know, we're definitely going to get back with you many times. One last question. Do you still have some property down here in Collier County, or did you sell that?
No, I sold it.
Oh, geez. We were going to put a house on it for you.
Huh?
We were going to build a house for you down here on that property.
Well, you know, I still may come down that way. I haven't decided. You know, I'm still looking around up this way. You guys got great weather down there, but the hunting that you guys do compared to the hunting I do is a little different. I got to be a little up north for that. You know?
All right, Bob.
You don't have enough of. Yeah.
Well, Tim,
your deer are a little bit too small for me. Yeah, I'd stay in Wisconsin where the bucks are big, you know.
Well, Tim's on the hook for your all-inclusive paid vacation. I don't know if it's 2 or 3 weeks. Where are you going to put him? On the beach? You put him on the water? What do you want to do?
Yeah, we'll take care of you, Bob.
You treated me nice when I was down there, gentlemen.
Yeah, all right.
You know, the few times I came down there to visit with you and then do some classes, you treated me like kings, and it's an honor and a privilege to know you and congratulate you on the podcast and continuing success and everything else, man. That's all that matters. And my phone is always open. Call anytime. I'd love to talk.
Bob Stash, ladies and gentlemen, 239 Uncensored. This is going to be a top one. We can't top this one. Thanks, Bob. We appreciate it. We'll catch up with you. Hit us up on Facebook Messenger. Give us a call. We're always here. Thanks, brother.
Absolutely. I'm going to need a cold beer soon, so I'll be calling you guys.
Yeah, you got it, buddy. Be safe up there.
All right, brothers. God bless and Godspeed.
Back at you.
Bye-bye.
Uncensored. Don't forget to like us and share on Facebook.
That was fun.